Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Get me out, be the biggest little flirt. Well, I might have.
Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is the Shame-Free Zone. I'm your host, Veronica Monet. My guest this evening is Dr. Susan Campbell, and she has authored 9 books about relationships and conflict resolution. Right up my alley. This is going to be an interesting interview, I am quite certain. She's been on CNN's Newsnight and Good Morning America and the Dr. Dean Adele Show, which I've been on CNN 3 times, not Newsnight, but haven't made Good Morning America, but been on the Dr. Dean Adele Show. He was actually very polite to me. That was years and years ago. She's also lectured at Harvard, Stanford, and UCLA. Seems like she and I are running in a lot of the same circles. She has made millions, lost millions, lived in other cultures, and spent 2 years sailing her 47-foot sailboat halfway around the world. Okay, now I'm completely out of my league. And she's got several books, as I indicated. One is called The Couple's Journey, Beyond the Power Struggle, and Getting Real. I'm particularly interested in this one called Truth and Dating, Finding Love by Getting Real. I'm all about honesty is the best policy, so that's going to be an interesting conversation. Dr. Campbell, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you, Veronica. I'm happy to be with you.
Very glad to have you here too. And which book is actually your most recent one?
Saying What's Real. What's Real is 7 statements that bring your conversation into the present moment. And then the one right before that is the one that you mentioned, Truth in Dating. So
Saying What Is Real, is that do you think that's mostly for couples, or do you find that even maybe employers are using that?
Oh, yeah. Saying What's Real is a general communication manual for not just intimate relationships, but work with your kids, friends, even people that maybe push your buttons.
Right. And like
all of those people. Friends,
we all have plenty of people in those categories. It's true. Well, so your Truth in Dating must have done pretty well then.
Truth in Dating has done the least well of all my books.
Really?
And I think it's the best book. So that just says to me that maybe the culture isn't quite ready for my best thinking. I got to tone it down a little. Truth in Dating may be a tad too radical for most book buyers. But
yeah, no, it's kind of interesting. Cause
probably
I was,
not for your audience, I think. You know.
I hope it's not for my audience, but I have to tell you, I just watched this little skit on Saturday Night Live, which is a popular show on television, and it was very interesting because it was all about the lies that you should tell a guy when you're dating him.
Oh,
that's still out there.
Oh, sure.
Still out there.
Definitely. It's definitely. I get interviewed for Cosmopolitan magazine, and the young women who interview me, they get a lot of good information, but a lot of it can't be printed for their readership or for their editors.
Right.
They love talking to me, but then they know they can't say this stuff in their magazine. So it's this weird discrepancy, but they keep calling me for, like, counsel or something.
Oh, why?
So this, I don't know. We're talking about why Truth in Dating didn't sell as well as my other books.
But, well, you know, I know you actually counseled.
I made up a theory, but part of what the whole truth-telling movement is about not believing the theories that your mind makes up. So
right, and it actually sounds like
you go, oh, there I go, spinning a little story to make myself feel more comfortable or knowledgeable.
It sounds like some of your material probably incorporates a little bit of NVC or nonviolent communication. Is that true, or do you?
Oh yes, our work comes from some of the same roots, but not entirely, because I see communication more as an awareness practice. But NVC is moving in that direction too. You know, and certainly the stuff that I talk about, holding differences and things like that, are things that if you do NVC, you'll learn to hold differences. So they're very compatible. You know,
I wonder if you talk about, you know, kind of being in the moment, in the present, being mm-hmm. in the present moment. Is that from a spiritual practice?
Daily life is spiritual practice for me, and that spiritual practice is relaxing into each moment just as it is, and I guess just experiencing life in me and me in life, and the thing that, you know, whatever you call me. So that's sort of the human being in a body, but spiritual. But then the thing that interferes with feeling that oneness, I believe, and I don't know where this comes from in terms of spiritual writings or teachers, but I'm sure teachers teach this, is that what interferes with our experiencing this oneness are a lot of unfinished business from our past that needs to be cleared, and inadequacy fears and all that. And those come up beautifully in an intimate relationship, where you can form a safe partnership to really reveal yourself and be transparent. So that's really what Truth and Dating is about. It's about beginning that process right away when you first are really interested in somebody, saying, let's be practice partners together. Let's grow and deepen our experience of being life itself together. However, you know, maybe we don't share that language, but we're going to tell the truth and see where it takes us.
There you go. I used to teach workshops.
And you tell the truth, and it will take you everywhere you need to go in terms of any of those spiritual practices that you also may have learned and may be great. But truth-telling is another spiritual practice to deepen your self-realization.
Well, I remember they at One Taste, the couples used to call themselves research partners.
Uh-huh, and that comes from Morehouse, I think. But
yeah,
I've actually
yeah.
used that term too, because we used to call ourselves the laboratory method. Back when I was teaching at University of Massachusetts, all our classes were the laboratory method of learning about human relationships. We'd create a laboratory where we studied our own feelings and interactions. always self-observing in a group setting.
Well, that sounds very productive. So, what do you think? How do you deal with? I know you work with couples and individuals, as well as writing books and appearing on television. Do you find that there's a difficulty in getting couples, in particular, out of the adversarial competition model? There seems to be a lot of that, from my experience. I'm just wondering how you have found that to be.
Well, I'm not sure what you perceive when you say adversarial competition model. I guess you probably mean things like the typical blaming and judging, you know, and you need to change. Is that what you mean because I'm trying to make it real for myself so I can answer the question.
I think what I encounter a lot of times with couples is the idea of wanting to win the argument.
Oh, yeah.
Of it's getting so entrenched in, no, I know you did say that.
Yeah. Well, see,
no, I
interrupt couples right away. When couples get into that, I start from a paradigm where first I let them know that we're going to be using whatever comes up for them to deepen their self-understanding, you know. So whatever happens with the marriage or the relationship, they're gonna grow and benefit, and they're already being practice partners, or like you said, research partners.
Right.
And So I do quite a bit of instructing, but I let them talk to each other. So if they start getting into a right-wrong battle, trying to win the argument, I'll just say, wait, we're getting into a right-wrong battle here, and that's the old paradigm. We're not living by that anymore. You know, we're living by the, you know, we're each going to have to hear and deal with what's right here in front of us. She said this. What did he say? How do you feel? So that's what I mean by present-centered communication. It just stop making up ideas about what's going on. What did he just say? What did you feel when he just said that? What thought came into your head when he just said that? You know, like right here and now. Keep the fight in the room.
Yeah.
I never said that phrase before, but I love it. So that's what I help people do, and clarify what the fight's about and look deeper into yourself. What's the button? It's always about somebody's button or trigger, or the two synonymous words there. It's like a automatic self-protective or aggressive kind of reaction comes from hearing just a word or a tone of voice that re-stimulates old wounds, let's just say. Let's put it in a quick version. So I guide people to allow the moment to be there, the moment of pain, and just feel into the ouch of their partner's words, and it'll usually bring them into some kind of self-compassion that gets them to re-experience unfinished business. Not necessarily having a memory flashback, but an awful lot of people do. About, you know, traumas and mini traumas. Most of the traumas are mini traumas, but there are many traumatized people in relationships. So anyway, they get to feel deeper levels of themselves just through trying to tell the truth, because you can't hide it when your buttons get pushed, because you start doing a lot of automatic things.
Now, what is that process? Because absolutely, that is how it feels. So you start doing a lot of automatic things. So it's just like programming always that goes back to our childhood, or what is that about?
Well, the most basic thing it goes back to is our animal origins. Of just animals trying to survive and not even having to have any thoughts about it. I mean, we make problems with our mind. We make them up, or we make them worse than they are. But in the old days, when we were, you know, biologically, just biological beings, or, you know, I don't know who we were then, but we come from animals that have this nervous system that sends out certain kind of chemicals, danger, danger, danger kind of chemicals when there's a threat to our survival, like out in the jungle. And we still got some of that programming that there are threats out there, and that we have to perceive threats. So something that's unexpected or unwanted now in our own. Now there's no tigers after us, but because we're humans and we've evolved. But our partner looks at us a certain way and then turns his back on me or something like that, well, then I'm going to have some gut reaction, and it's going to be like danger, danger. And it'll be my abandonment fear getting triggered, but I won't think of what it is. I'll just feel this automatic feeling. So it goes back to first our animal and these, you know, buttons and triggers, and then it goes back to childhood where we were traumatized and had reactions to things, but it wasn't safe to just shake and call attention to ourselves. Maybe we had to freeze up to protect ourselves from further harm, if we're getting beaten or something, heaven forbid, but kids are. But particularly just a criticism or over control or something.
So it's a
it can be sort of traumatizing, but I wouldn't use the word trauma. But it leaves you with wounds, and then the pain is unprocessed until the button gets pushed, and then the pain has a chance to get processed a little bit. But
so we can kind of
need guidance from a therapist first to be able to do this. But it's
so
all
we can
in the
kind of we can kind of look at some of these hot buttons as gifts, really.
Oh yeah, they all are, because they show us where our unfinished business is. And a relationship, see, we all know that a marriage relationship is a great context for getting these buttons pushed. But you can start out looking for your buttons in your dating. That's what Truth in Dating says. It's a new model. It's radical about dating, because you can start saying, you know, get to know somebody well enough to know that you want to get to know them, and then you start talking about your buttons and the things that you do when your buttons get pushed and what that
comes
from, as far as you can tell, you know, with the therapy or the self-help books you've experienced.
And what do you think of the Harville Hendricks model?
Very good, very good. I kind of discovered that same model about the same time he did, I remember, and I used to call it the helping each other heal model, really taking the threat out of your partner's, like my partner's disabilities can be a drag on me, or they're emotional. I don't mean disabilities like physical, but they're emotional weaknesses, because then I have to somehow deal with that all the time. But if, and I take it personally, but then the way Harville Hendricks puts it out is, if you want to help your partner heal, this is the way you behave toward them, and it winds up being much more loving.
And
you wind up not taking their behavior personally.
So, sure, and it's actually a gift to our own personal growth. One of the things I try to remind people is, you know, you're going to have to do this growth whether your partner's around or not, so thank them for bringing it up. No.
Yeah, even if you're the only one doing the growing,
right?
It'll affect your partnership. And it's awfully hard. This is sort of that win-lose competitive paradigm, too. It's so hard to not get into thinking, well, you know, it's really not fair that I'm doing all the growing and my partner's not. But I don't think, if you look really into yourself, I don't think it's a question of fairness, but it's probably that you really want to be met, that your needs for connection are, you know, are real and strong. And maybe, you know, if you knew what the real need was, maybe you could get it met.
Well, yes. And I guess part of it, too, is stretching kind of towards the gap between two people. Like, do you find that couples sometimes have complementary attributes, and maybe they pick partners because they need to be a little bit more like their partner, and
yeah,
vice versa?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so you got, like, maybe one's real stingy with the money and the other one's a little too, you know, just blowing money right and left, and between
yeah.
the two of them, they learn how to kind of meet in the middle.
Oh yeah, I had that with my former husband. He was really good at taking care of himself, relaxing, really good at self care. I mean, he had many other good talents, you know, but he was like extremely good at self care, and I was a little more of a workhorse type. I mean, I took decent care of myself, but I didn't like pamper myself, and also he spent more money on himself and stuff. So, you know, when I saw him doing it, I kind of found my own shadow there and started taking better care of myself and spending more money on myself in a sensible way. And he likewise got a little more fire in his belly for his work. And started achieving more, because I was like the achiever, and, you know, he was like the underachiever. So I was probably the overachiever. So anyway, yeah, we totally learned from each other, and we were doing it consciously. And it did create conflicts, because I, you know, I didn't help with the money thing enough. And even though he tried, and I, you know, I knew he was trying, it hurt his self-image and it made him feel like a burden to me. So we had other problems. We learned. But see, that's the dark side of these differences. But we really also took the good stuff and really learned. And we both honor each other, even though we're no longer married.
Well, that happens too now. I've been divorced for 7 years, and I still have a loving connection with my ex-husband, even though we're completely incompatible at this point.
Yeah. You see more and more of that. You know, it's not even unusual now. It used to be people would go, oh, you're friends with your ex. Oh, how amazing. But it's not, right?
Yes.
It's a new folks. You know, this is what's happening. You don't have to go by anybody else's beliefs. Do what feels right, you know? And that's the other thing about this whole getting real thing that I teach. It's just, you know, we're all unique, and it's safe to have a little more differentiation in the world of maybe points of view or just flavors of however we be in the world.
Yeah, Yeah, it really is. Now, you know, you've been doing this for a long time, but what was your initial impetus? What caused you to want to go into relationships and dating and marriage?
Well, my parents had a really good marriage, and they made relationships look really easy. But when I looked around, when I got a little older, in teen years, and I got to realize what was going on in my friends' families, I could see a lot of dysfunctionality and then trouble with relationships as a result. And then every boyfriend I had came from a dysfunctional family, and I married a guy who came from, you know, a somewhat dysfunctional family, not horrible, but I got to be in a dysfunctional relationship then. And I, you know, just like codependent and not saying what we really felt all the time and stuff. And so I realized that I had a lot more to learn. I don't know, my parents really, they'd made it look so easy. And so I guess what motivated me were my own failures and struggles to understand what it takes to make a good relationship, even though I could see from my parents it was easy. But I had a hell of a time finding a partner who could be easy with.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you had to...
I have a lot now. You know, now I do, because I've actually decided to be with somebody who's got a little more similar temperament to me. But, you know, in the old days, when I was in my high growth phase, I'm 70 now, so, you know, right, my growth is behind me. That's a joke. That's a high growth phase of my 30s,
notice,
20s, all the encounter groups then.
Notice I wasn't laughing. I was horrified. I'm glad that was a joke.
But in my high growth phase then, I would do a lot more.
Well, the listeners, and I doubt that there's anybody out there that couldn't relate to the idea of it being difficult to find somebody, and
mm-hmm.
And then you know, say that you have. Do you, at this point, is there a solution, a key that helps one narrow the search so that you can find the perfect partner?
Well, I think it does have to do with inner wholeness. I was kind of implying in my high growth phase, I went through a few different husbands, real strong, deep, intimate relationships that went on for like 6, 7, 10, 11 years, okay? Actually, I had 4 marriages, all right? And then, you know, by the time I was 50, I had done my intense learning in the laboratory of relationship and marriage. But what went on during those years was always opposites attract. It was always a different opposite to help me integrate, I'll say it quickly, you know, and integrate a different part of my unexpressed self. So, you know, with the one I mentioned, I got to learn a little more to be relaxed and laid back and take care of myself. And each one of those husbands had intense growth. And now, I don't know, I'm still growing with my present partner for sure. I think there's going to be just as much growth this way, but there's no like heavy. Well, the buttons are still there. I can feel my neglect button getting pushed. That was always a bad one for me. I have memories I know for sure that I wasn't picked up that much when I was a crying little baby. Okay,
mm.
So I have some neglect in my genes, and I've always felt this when I work. You know. Work on my relationship stuff, that I'm sort of like a hungry little baby, you know, deep down in my, you know, my most passionate place. And
yeah,
you know, kind of talk about the shame-free zone, you know, it's kind of a thing that, you know, women like to hide, you know, a hungry little baby.
Right.
Magnetic woman, you know, not this needy thing, you know. insatiable. So, you know, I really did work through a lot of that, but I can still feel it coming in this relationship, because he works very much. He's very into his career and his job and all.
Yeah.
And I respect that, and I'm so into mine, you know, so it's great. But I get my little, I'm I'm not lovable, I'm not being cared for, I'm not worthy, all the stuff that kind of, that's a flavor. You know, I don't really think I totally even felt, I mean, had those beliefs during my life, but there was a flavor of that. There was always a flavor of you know, something's wrong with me, you know. But that's only comes up when you get your button pushed. Otherwise, I feel fine. You know, I hardly ever get that button pushed. But anyway, this particular relationship now, it gets pushed in like subtle ways. But I don't get flared up at all. I go loving toward myself. I go, oh yeah, there. You know, there's a little vestige of it, and certainly appreciation for not having it flare up in any big way where I have like a panic attack because the man didn't call or something.
Oh, this is
I've done that,
really.
It's just so silly.
Right. You know what? That's great. What you just said, you said that you go toward loving yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine, you know, I found myself, my ears really perked up around that. I imagine some listeners would probably like to know just exactly what are some of the things one can do to love themselves.
Oh, good, because this is exactly what I work with every client on over and over. First, we start with an incident that pushed your buttons. I mean, I'm going to give you the sort of steps to work with yourself here.
Okay.
We have time, yeah.
Fabulous, yeah.
First, there's an incident that pushed your button, like, your partner said, I'm going to bed now, and you feel this, your heart sink because you were hoping for a longer evening together. Okay, so you get some kind of a button pushed, a rejection button. So if you think of some instance where you had some kind of a button pushed, it could be a long time ago or now, in a relationship.
Right.
And then you just go into the memory of that, bring it to mind, bring it into your body, sense what you were wearing and any, you know, who was there, the smells. Okay, so you're there and you feel the feelings, you bring them back, but now you're doing it consciously. You're going back to that triggered state, but you're just doing it a little bit, just to get into the into sort of like, okay, let me be with this and not resist it. Because what we're trying to do is complete old business. There's some unfinished business associated with this. It's somewhere back there. You just have to trust that. Don't even worry about getting a memory or a reason why. Because most of the buttons are pre-verbal stuff, first and second year of life anyway. And then we have other confirming incidents that happen later that we pin it on, like you say, oh, well, you know, when I was 7, a boy pulled my underpants down. Well, something else might have happened when you were 6 months old that you'll never remember. So pin it on whatever you want to. And we don't know reasons for things exactly, but it does seem that there's actual incidents that happened. And so your body has that memory. So you just let yourself feel what it felt like the other night when your guy said he's going to bed, you felt that panicky feeling or that, oh no. And you just feel the feelings, and you if you sort of be with uncomfortable feelings, it slightly transforms them. But what it also does, especially if you stay with it long enough, it'll kind of connect you to whatever's unfinished in your past. It just tends to, because there's an energetic similarity. So then I go to, I'm lying in my crib, and I'm crying, and nobody's coming, you know, or I'm just giving you a gross example. But
no,
this is
right.
The kind of thing that does happen to me. I will actually get flashbacks of myself in the crib reaching up with my little hands and then kind of giving up and going to sleep and learning to suck my thumb. And I was a thumb sucker until I was 5 years old. I went to kindergarten as a thumb sucker.
All right.
A gamble, you know? And I was always seen as great. Even as a child, I was seen as like this super, super person, you know? Smart and talented and funny. You know, people would put me up on the stage and stuff, my parents and my relatives. But I still sucked my thumb. I mean, I was this, you know, like, I was bold and confident, but I had this obvious emotional wound.
Wow.
I was ashamed of it when I got to school, and so I stopped. You know,
yeah.
Geez, the other kids don't have their hands in their mouths. I don't want to look like a big baby, so I stopped right away.
Oh, my gosh.
I remember all this. I have a great memory. So anyway, it's just about self-compassion. It's like a compassionate self-inquiry. I get my button pushed, and I feel with it, that feeling, and then it kind of connects me to the past. And sometimes if it's like a real trauma, like a rape or beating or something, you might find your body shaking if you let yourself be it. And just let that go a little bit, you know. I mean, depending on how much comfort, what your comfort level is for discomfort or
right.
uncertainty. So, you know, what trauma theorists tell us is you go back and you heal the trauma, but in homeopathic doses. So you just dip in to the really painful stuff or the stuff where you're shaking or wanting to scream, and you just dip into it a little bit to your own tolerance. And it really, really helps to have a guide, someone who knows this territory, who can kind of handhold you and guide you, because we tend to want to avoid staying with an uncomfortable feeling unless there's kind of a nurturing presence like myself kind of having you stay with it. But you can do it for yourself.
Mm.
You can.
Mm.
You know, especially if you kind of have an intuitive hit of what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, yeah, really.
And some of this is in both Truth in Dating, Getting Real, and Saying What's Real, little bits about what to do when your buttons get pushed. And there'll be more coming up in my next two books.
So this is really helpful, because I think the tendency is for people to want to assume that if they're feeling bad, it's, their partner obviously did something to evoke those feelings.
Yeah, I used to joke. Because, you know, I wrote this book called Beyond the Power Struggle. So I'd say, I'd say to the audiences, you know you're in a power struggle when you want your partner to change so that you can feel better.
Mm.
And people laugh. They recognize themselves. But that's what state you're in most of the time when things are not going well. Gee, if my partner would only change this thing, then I could be okay.
Yeah.
So I teach this if-only exercise in my workshops sometimes, where I say, what's the if-only? If only my partner could do this, then I could. You know, then I, if only my partner would stop telling me what to do, then I could feel empowered to get stuff done. Okay, so you look at the second half, feel empowered to get stuff done. Okay, that's your issue. You're kind of pinning it to your partner's behavior, but that is your issue. Ask for help with that. Go back and say, instead of saying, if only you would nag me less or whatever, I could feel empowered, you'd say, I'm wanting some help feeling empowered. You find your own way to say it. This is an issue for me. You know, you say, this is an issue for me. I need your help with this. And there's a way that you've been talking to me or a number of times you've been talking to me that I think actually puts me in struggle with you instead of leaving me to struggle with myself. And I'm gonna just ask you to try to let me struggle with this myself for a week or so. And I'd ask you to not tell me to fix the fence. You know, give me a couple weeks without being reminded and see what I do. See if anything happens differently in my relationship to myself. So now I'm totally improvising on that one, because people have to do their if only whatever way they want to.
Sure, absolutely. But so you're actually creating some detachment for you and your partner, where you're saying, "Hey, don't try to help me. I am dealing with this, and let's check in a week from now or something like that."
Well, that's just something that somebody's requesting, you know.
Yeah.
That's an example of something somebody might request, and in a more just normal friend-to-friend way rather than mother-son dynamic or something, you know, just two equal people talking. And so that's what this whole Getting Real practice encourages, is it's just not thinking things mean so much, but just feeling what they do feel like. You know, what does it feel like? How are you experiencing this? And what are your ideas that come up about it, or your resistances, your judgments? But all of those ideas are things to be observed, not to be taken as real.
Not to be taken as real.
Yeah.
Very wise words.
Yeah. About 90% of the stuff that goes on in our lives is not to be taken as real because it's mental constructions. So what's left? But there's plenty left. If we would throw that stuff away, we'd be in the present moment with the juicy aliveness that's there when you're just looking in somebody's eyes and you don't know what to say. You know, you don't know what to say. Why not meet somebody on, you know, your first date like that, and you just look at her and not know what to say? You know, I do little dating coaching things for guys sometimes, you know. What about just living with the uncertainty of the moment and letting it be a creative time, you know?
Well, you know, guys and dating, now there's an interesting thought. Have you heard at all about the trend of to stay home and just look at online porn and play video games? It seems to be kind of sweeping the world when it comes to men.
I believe it.
Yeah.
I've had clients like that for years.
I'm sure. How do you help?
But it's getting worse, I suppose. Sure.
Oh, it is.
I'm sure,
for the clients that you've had that are, you know, kind of oriented towards that way, have you had any luck in getting them to do face-to-face communication and actually go out with a real-life girl?
Oh, sure. But
how did you do it?
That'll be inviting them to a group that I'm doing.
Oh.
Having them come to a group that I'm doing and get kind of re-socialized. I only have one group going on right now, and I call it the Honesty Salon. And it's appropriate for some people who would be porn addicts on the Internet or something, but not necessarily everybody, you know. I mean, because there's so many other factors that make one a good candidate for the Honesty Salon. First of all, they should have read my books, and if they resonate with those ideas, then anybody's a good candidate for the Honesty Salon. It's a kind of group where you get re-socialized, but it's such a higher level of consciousness than the stuff I was doing when it was more of a therapy group.
Mm.
Where I was really trying to give people ways to relate to one another. But, you know, this Honesty Salon, people learn ways to relate to each other anyway, because the getting real true skills are relationship skills.
Well, what about people who say that, you know, because there's a saying out there that says honesty is the best policy. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about getting real and being honest, I think a lot of people will go, oh, wait a minute, you know, there's just certain things one should never talk about. What do you...
Well, the big thing on this question is most people's honesty is not very high quality honesty or high quality information. It's, again, thoughts about something, judgments, assessments, predictions. It usually comes from our wishes and our fears, you know, if we're giving somebody feedback, for example. But, and that's the kind of, you know, when, you know, honesty is like, okay, do you tell your boss what you really think of him, et cetera, stuff like that.
Right.
Well, what you really think of him is going to start out as a bunch of judgments and labels. So you need to look at what's going on in you that needs to learn something from being in this situation. And when you learn it, you'll know how to handle that boss. It's like the reason this boss is a pain in your ass is because you haven't developed something in yourself that's resourceful to deal with that part of life yet, and it's your life. Or you can quit the job, because not all people should you have to deal with. You know, not everybody would you choose to do that. Somebody else will choose to be with that person, but it's not yours to be with or do for.
Yeah, yeah. Well... So you're basically, what do you think about this thing? Because I think what I'm hearing, and this is something that I sometimes advise, okay, you know, there may be certain people that you don't really want to have that level of intimacy with, But if you are attempting to build a future with a particular individual, then the degree to which you're able to be transparent and honest increases the likelihood that that relationship is going to survive the test of time.
Right, right. And then you want to, you know, and I didn't actually finish what I should have said before, but I kind of lost my train of thought, so thanks for bringing this back. What I was going to say was then what you need to do is have some honesty skills, because if you do value honesty, but you know sometimes your honesty isn't of the highest quality because all of us behave in automatic ways and just say shit that we think is true at the moment, but then if you examine it, it's more about your own projections. So anyway, you get more skillful when you learn about projections, when you learn about the phenomena of projection, when you learn exercises like from the books and from the honesty salons to learn to see, oh my God, every time I start labeling and getting especially interested in somebody else's sharing or start to want to help them or change them, That energy, you have to look at where that's coming from in me, and very often there's some connection to my own unfinished business or my own disowned aspects or something, and so people see that's the phenomenon of projection, something that I'm still not clear about in myself. I'll project onto the bad guy out there somewhere.
Yes. Right. I just finished a book called The Dark Side of the Light Chasers.
Oh yeah. That's a good book about projections.
Yeah, it's by Debbie Ford.
And valuing your projections. Yeah, this is exactly the point of view that I'm putting across here, is it's value. Take this whole notion of seeing things about yourself that might be unpleasant to see as a gift. And see what you can discover, because once you find that, oh, that unfinished piece, like usually it has to do with a button, like, oh, I've got issues about rejection or abandonment or I resist being controlled or I have authority problems or issues or, you know, which will sometimes come out in money issues. So blah, blah, blah. You see you've got some kind of a weakness. And then you have a place to look when your buttons get pushed, and a place to put that loving attention, that curious kind of loving attention of, whoa, boy, I just got upset there. Let me feel into that upset and feel it more deeply. And like I said, then you might get the flashbacks or the connection with old trauma that was unfinished. And you get a chance to consciously go back and redo a little bit of the experiencing, and the unfinished business eventually goes away, so you can be present and creative and make the world a better place. Actually, do good. So,
what a concept.
Humanity is more in a, you know, like fucking up and learning from our experience phase right now. It's not,
right.
You know, we're not exactly contributors in the overall huge scheme of things, but you know, some of us are. You know, there's some kind of a mixture of things going on, I guess, on this planet. I have no idea, really.
It's hard to tell, isn't it?
There's a lot going on. I'm not even going to venture into that one. I'm enjoying myself. And
yes, you are. You are definitely enjoying yourself. So if you had to tell people what the number one secret is to a happy relationship, then is it about dealing with your own projections and nurturing your inner child, or how would you term that?
I think being humble, each person having a certain degree of humility about the fact that there's still a lot for them to learn. You know, and it'll, if you really have that, you won't go to that I'm right place. You'll go to curiosity and learn, and what can I learn from this? And you'll just feel like every thing that happens to you is a win, rather than half the things that happen to you are horrible things that you wish never would have happened. I mean, because you just, it's just like, it's learning, the first true skill is experiencing what is, just really learning to be with what is, and that is the key to everything, and relationships can really help you do that if you have an intent. Shared intent really helps a lot in this case. But even if one person has the intent, they can transform themselves in a relationship.
Yeah, that is true. Your partner does not necessarily have to be on board for this in order for you to be able to impact the relationship.
Yeah, and grow tremendously yourself, so much so that you are happy beyond what the other person's doing, and you can appreciate them for what they do give you. That doesn't mean you don't still nudge at them and tell the truth in ways that are uncomfortable for them, like something that you're thinking or feeling that might be unpleasant for them to hear. You know, you don't dull your own senses, but still you can do a lot by yourself in a loving relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, one of the things I often tell people is that you'll change, your partner will either change or the relationship will have to change.
Yeah. And often relationships end, and that's not the end of the world.
No. No, as long as you walk away with you know, the growth, then you have won. You have won something beautiful from the encounter.
Mm-hmm. I'm very proud of the last two chapters in the book, Truth in Dating, where I talk about how to end things consciously. And I've always done that with my partners. You know, we've had conversations both before and much later about what were we feeling? What, you know, kind of clearing all the air, all the things that, what did it feel like when that happened for you? I mean, just you know, sharing unfinished feelings and appreciating each other, and what did we learn, and what are we glad to be rid of, and what are we going to miss, and just kind of, it's grief work, really, completion work, and it helps you move on.
That is beautiful. That is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, there's little rituals and questionnaires and things that you can create based on the last two chapters in Truth in Dating. People do it. No, and people call me once in a while and go, will you guide us in this? Will you give us one closure session? You know, just one closure session, and people feel like then they can feel a heart connection but say goodbye, and I don't know.
Wow.
For some people it takes a lot more than that.
Well, you know, I know one couple who changed. They actually had, for their divorce, they had a ceremony, a public ceremony that their friends came to. Mm-hmm. And they did something similar to what you're talking about, only they did it publicly. They made commitments on how they were going to deal with each other as a divorced couple.
Terrific. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. My my third ex and I, he was in this growth business too. We used to lead couples groups together, and we had a disengagement party. In fact, we had it at Barbara Marx Hubbard's house. A lot of your listeners know her. And he gave me a disengagement ring because it was part of our divorce settlement that we had these gems. So he gave me the sapphire ring as a disengagement ring, and he made the big pronouncement in front of, you know, the few friends that happened to be in Washington, D.C. at the time. When we were all
wow.
There. We were at a conference or something. So
I just heard
very theatrical in those days. You know, steps as a couple and all that.
Yeah, Barbara Marx Hubbard was actually on a telesummit on the Shift Network that I listened to recently. It's interesting you mentioned her name.
Yeah. Well, she's pretty well known.
Yes, of course. Of course she is. Well, so we're running out of time here. It's gone awfully fast. And you're a delight. You have such a great sense of humor, and it's obvious that you are walking your talk because you're very happy. What would you like to leave our listeners with the last minute or two here, as far as maybe where they can get your books, how they can contact you, what kind of upcoming public events you may be having, anything you want to let us know about?
I'm for sure going to do a two-day Getting Real workshop on February 11th and 12th. 2012. That's the only one I have scheduled for sure, but that's a two-day workshop giving you the skills you need to speak truthfully in a way that will lead to self-awareness and successful relationships, because we do want to have successful relationships. So,
oh God, we all do.
Teach you juicier ways to speak your truth that also feel safe and responsible. So that workshop is one of the things I do. I also do these honesty salons, but it's only in Sebastopol right now, twice a month. And if you look on my website, which is susancampbell.com, all my contact information is there, and there's a way to subscribe to my e-zine, my free e-zine, and there's a way to email me if you want to, like, know about the teleclasses or this honesty salon. There is one in San Jose that one of my coaches, I also train Getting Real coaches. I train people to do what I do, and I'll be having a coach training teleseminar coming up pretty soon, and just like an eight weeks for an hour a week, and then you work with your homework buddy. So a lot of people are looking for some kind of right livelihood, and this does not require a PhD, but it's better than a PhD, because I've had so much education, and you just get it all in one, you know, 8-week course. the best of Susan Campbell. I've had some good teachers too. I've had some very good teachers, you know. But anyway, so I'm teaching that. So that would be something. You just go to my website. You can read about Getting Real coaching and become a coach and what is coaching like that.
Real coaching, I love it.
Getting Real coaching. Then, so there's an honesty salon down in San Jose. If anybody's down in that area, you can just get in touch with me, and I'll tell you how to contact the facilitator there. But she's one of my coaches.
Well, thank you. Dr. Campbell, for putting such positive things out into the world. In this era of Mars and Venus, you are a breath of fresh air.
Thank you so much, Veronica. It was a delight speaking with you.
Well, we'll have you back again sometime.
Okay, good.
All right, and best of luck with the new book, too. And what was the name of the new book again?
The new book, I didn't say the name, but the first part of the title is going to be Real Intimacy, in keeping with the whole Getting Real theme, Real Intimacy, and the subtitle, Learning the Language of Lasting Love.
Ah, beautiful, beautiful. I want an autographed copy.
Okay, stay in touch.
I sure will.
Okay.
And to my listeners, next week I am going to be interviewing Jamila Magenalt, and she's going to be talking to us about orgasms. So I hope that you will tune in. It's actually called about her book, which is called Have You Ever Had an Orgasm? A Woman's Guide to Everyday Bliss. So that should be an exciting follow-up to tonight's topic. Until then, have a great evening, and I'll see you next Monday.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.